Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, season's greetings. I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. Our theme this weekend is home for the holidays. And one of the distinctive things about home is the aroma. Wouldn't you say so, Des?
The desserts alone.
Like some of the people we're going to meet this hour, their home smells like something died in your mouth and rotted there. But even if it's not perfect, it's home. How about you? Is there anything you would change about your hometown?
Probably the traffic, because it takes forever to get from one place to another.
I'd like to keep the building smaller.
Make the parking cheaper.
Tired of pollution. See, there's a car right there. Pollution.
Yeah, if I was to change one thing in Anchorage, I would move the airport.
Chelsea is a small town. We love that. But I wouldn't mind a few more restaurants.
If there were like more interesting things to do, like a more cosmopolitan environment, that would be nice. But then it wouldn't be home anymore. So I don't think I would change anything about it.
And where is that perfect place? That gentleman was speaking of his hometown, Stevens Point, Wisconsin.
Well, we also heard voices from Anchorage, Alaska, Chelsea, Michigan, New York, and Seattle. Well, home for the holidays, of course, means different things to different people. And for more than 80 homeless people in Kirkland, Washington, home during this holiday season is a church parking lot. In the Seattle area, there are two officially sanctioned tent cities. They're part of the area's shelter system. The tent cities move every 3 months or so, and they're collectively run by the residents. They have strict codes of conduct, and they even have garbage service and showers. And unlike most homeless shelters, the couples can actually stay together in the tents, and that really does make life seem a little more like home, especially during the holidays. Producer Sarah Gustavus went to meet the folks who call Kirkland's Tent City home. First to show her around were Angela and James.
I'm Angela Marshall. We are in Tent City, and I am taking this fine lady on a tour of our fair city. We're looking up on a little, like a small little hillside, and we're seeing rows of tents. Everybody gets to name their tent. That's how we keep track of where everybody's tent is. People make up all kinds of fun names. Aloha, Fun City, ours is Camp Marshall. Everybody has different names, different styles. You know, some people decorate theirs up real neat for the holidays, and you know, it's your little home.
Everybody here are people, just like anybody else. They just don't have a house, and they don't have cars. Some have jobs, some don't have jobs. But everybody needs something. A roof over their head, a family to call a family, a Christmas to call a Christmas. You know, a lot of people here, their Christmas is their tent. I'm going to have a Christmas no matter if I'm in a tent or not.
You know, I've never been homeless before, so it's kind of a new thing to me.
Can you tell me your name?
Stephanie Hansen. It's not the same as having your own place where you can, you know, just go to the kitchen and get something to eat or make yourself a pizza or something like that, because we just have a microwave and coffee pots. So, you know, you don't have that luxury. It's a major culture shock for somebody who's never been homeless before. We had been living in Spokane, and we had, a two-bedroom apartment, paying rent, everything was great. My son was in school. And then I kind of had a nervous breakdown, and I decided to leave my family. And so I lost my family. This is what happens. My son's been in foster care for a year and a half.
So what are you feeling right now?
I'm really depressed, actually, because it's the holiday season. You want to be with your family. You want to be indoors and putting up a tree and Christmas lights and all that kind of stuff. And I'm living in a tent. you try to keep your spirits up and try to be happy about things, and it's just really hard. You don't know what to expect or when you might be able to get out of the situation.
My name is Adama. I do mortgages, and I do loans, and right now with the default market and what everything's going on here, closing deals doesn't happen often. And I did go and visit the shelters, but the shelters doesn't work for me, because the shelters, how it works is that you have to check in like around 7 o'clock or something like that, and then you have to leave at 5 in the morning. But see, It may work for others, but it doesn't work for me because I have belongings and I also want to keep a steady job. And if my job and my hours doesn't, you know, match with those hours, then I'm pretty much have no place to stay. We have people that work for Microsoft coming here too, okay? But because they got a divorce with a wife and whatnot, they lose everything. They come here rather than going to friends. So it's, you have a lot of different people here.
See, we donated blood yesterday so we can go give our mother something for Christmas. You know, and we didn't take any of that money and say, hey, let's go get whatever, candy, whatever. You know, we didn't take that money and go, you know, do anything with it. We spent that money on the $30 we got. That's all we had. We spent on Christmas presents for them. You know what I mean? In good spirit. You know what I mean? Just because we love them. And ever since then, you know, our tent's falling apart twice. Our air mattress went flat. We almost got hit by a Mack truck today. And all these things were and coming upon us. Like, it was like, and we're like, you know, geez. Or is it ever going to stop? We do good, bad still happens. Just got to keep on doing good.
I'm going to spend my Christmas with somebody else and give them a Christmas. I went down and got a tree for another family. And presents. I helped her get presents for her kids. And I'm going to go down and I'm going to have my Christmas with them. And that's important. Them little kids just smiled and faces lit up when they seen that Christmas tree and the lights and the Christmas that they thought they wouldn't have. That's my Christmas.
You just heard James, one of the residents of Tent City 4 in Kirkland, Washington, outside of Seattle. Thanks to producer Sarah Gustavus for gathering those voices. There's more about Seattle's tent cities for the homeless. Just go to our website at weekendamerica.org.
This weekend, a lot of college freshmen are coming back home for the first time, and what they and their parents find when they get back together can be a whole lot of change.
2 years ago, I was coming home for the holidays, and I'm talking with my mother about a religion class that I had just completed.
That's David Polk from Chicago.
My mom was raised Catholic, and my dad was raised Jewish, and I wasn't raised with really anything. And my mother is from Poland, so she goes, David, don't tell your father, but when you were 2 weeks old, you were secretly baptized. And I'm thinking to myself, what? I wasn't shocked that I was baptized, although I was surprised. I was more surprised at the fact that it was this big secret. Only a week later, we have this annual holiday dinner, and after a couple glasses of wine, which, of course, they're Polish, so they're kind of prone to that, they decide that we're going to do something different this year, and we're all going to go around the table, and everybody has to say something that the rest of the table didn't know about them. So my father is there, and, you know, my godmother is there, but she doesn't know that I know that she's my godmother, and my mom's there. So that comes to me, and I said, well, I just learned last week that I was secretly baptized, and my godmother was sitting next to me, and she almost started crying. She was in tears. She didn't have to be in the closet anymore about being my godmother. Not long after I learned that I was secretly baptized, I was with my Jewish grandmother, and she tells me, David, when you were in the hospital room, we gave you a secret bris. And I told her, well, at least part of that bris wasn't that much of a secret. Snip, snip.
Sometimes homecomings can be complicated by changed expectations. Karen Anderson from Superior, Wisconsin, was so happy to welcome her daughter home from college, she made her daughter's favorite foods, cheese balls, rice pudding, and potatoes au gratin.
My dad and my husband had always cut her own little tree in the woods of northern Minnesota when they cut our own. And so, of course, my dad is making sure her tree is perfect and, you know, and just everything was nice so that when she would come home, she would just, you know, kind of relish in the warmth and the love. I remember just feeling kind of a lump in my throat. I must have been showing more of that than I thought I was because she promptly said, Mom, if you're going to be so emotional each time I come home, I won't want to come home so much, which, you know, who knows if that would have been or not. But it promptly snapped me back to reality. It was a reminder that she had grown up and gone away to college, and she would probably be a guest from here on in. She wouldn't live at the house anymore.
I'm Tom Rule, and I'm from Macon, Georgia. I have a son who just finished his first semester at college, so this is the first Christmas he's come home from college. And for him, it's still home, but it's halfway not home. But for him, the big thing was the fact we started storing the vacuum cleaner in the middle of his room instead of in my closet. So he just kind of pushed it out of the way. But I think for him, that said, you know, I don't live here much anymore. On the other end of the spectrum, my wife's parents are having some health issues. This very well may be the last Christmas with my father-in-law. And at the same time, my grandfather is starting to shut down. Well, all of this has me thinking about this, I guess, the circle of life. And I sound middle-aged when I say this, but the whole being sandwiched between having parents who are older and getting ready to move on, and at the same time having a son who's in college and getting ready to move on as well. And here I am at 47, smack in between. So it's made me very aware of how life progresses. There's lots to celebrate. The trick's going to be remembering to celebrate and then not focus on the sad.
This weekend, Tom Rule has a diversion. He's playing keyboards with his big band at an annual Christmas event in downtown Macon, Georgia. Thank you to everybody who wrote and called. We love to hear from you. Our website makes it easy. Just come to weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
Congress done. Fertility up. Central Park horse carriages endangered. Good news, bad news, no news. Next on Weekend America. It's Weekend America from American Public Media. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. This show is dedicated to the weekend, and that includes taking stock, looking back at the past week. See, when we were cave people telling stories around the fire, the most important member of the group was not the hunter. No, it was the person who listened to the story and told everyone how to feel about it. Was it a good omen or a bad omen or nothing to be concerned about? And you might say, hey, that times have changed. Who needs that? I disagree, Des. I'm sorry. But I really believe we provide a valuable service with our segment entitled Good News, Bad News, or No News. This weekend, we welcome and congratulate National Book Award winner Sherman Alexie. Hey, Sherman.
Hi, Bill.
Columnist and former Reagan administration official Linda Chavez. Hi, Linda.
Hi there, Bill.
Author and columnist Dan Savage. Hello, Dan.
Hey, and I also was a former Reagan official.
So noted. Our first topic, the Democratic Congress has adjourned for the year. Overall, was 2007 a year of congressional good news, bad news, or no news?
I think it's great news. Whenever Congress can be kept out of getting us all into mischief and spending all of our money, it's a good thing. So the fact that they did almost nothing this year, we all would be cheering.
I think it's bad news because the American people that sent the Democrats back to Washington to control Congress wanted them to rein in the Bush administration. But due to the recalcitrance of the Republican Party and the filibuster, which when the Republicans were screaming and yelling about the Democrats threatening to do it, was an assault on democracy, they're using it to stop all progress and all attempts by the Democrats to rein in the Bush White House.
Sherman?
No news. I'm of the mind that a great democracy was a result of nothing happening or everything happening very slowly. It's revolutions that scare me.
So you and Linda agree on that. Two-party gridlock, okay.
Hey, that's what the American people want.
Pretty much, yeah, except I worry about the administration, like Dan says. They've gotten everything they've wanted, pretty much. So I find that shocking that a Democratic Congress can't control or at least present some sort of fight against Bush. It feels like a WWF match. It's all rigged to the end when W goes Hulkamaniac and wipes the floor with all the Democrats. So as a Democrat, I'm very ashamed of my politicians.
Okay, our next topic. For the first time in 35 years, the U.S. fertility rate is high enough to sustain our population, 2.1 babies per woman. This is good news, bad news, or no news?
It's good news for the Spears family. One day, Jamie Lynn Spears' offspring will be paying my Social Security benefits. I look forward to that day.
Okay, good news.
I think it's great news. And frankly, as somebody who just turned 60 this year, I plan on living at least another 30 years, and I'd like to have at least 25 years of Social Security payments rolling in. So somebody's got to pay for that. And if it isn't for an expanding population, then I don't know who will.
Well, anything that makes people have more sex is great. So I was trying to think of the reason. Is it the Bush administration causing this? Can we blame them? The reaction to a conservative administration is, you know, promiscuity.
Environmentalists say it's bad news because humans are using up the Earth's resources.
I wonder how many times they've looked out their window when they flew over the United States. It's one big open expanse down there, so I don't think we're in any great danger of using up our resources or running out of space for the people.
Yeah, it really is time to build some public housing in the Grand Canyon, all that wasted empty space.
How about this topic? In Manhattan this fall, a carriage horse named Smoothie got spooked by a breakdancing troupe, ran between two trees, carriage got stuck behind him, Smoothie collapsed and died. There have been other incidents too, and now the New York City Council is debating a ban on horse-drawn carriages in the streets. Good news, bad news, no news.
No news?
Yeah?
I grew up in farm country. I grew up with animals, and it has never once appealed to me to think that a horse's butt in front of me would somehow improve my love life.
How I've always felt about them is the same way I feel about going into an oriental rug store where there are no prices, you have to barter. But a more important point is the endless hypocrisy. Oh my God, these horses in Central Park, they're suffering, and oh my God, a horse died. And Manhattan is full of restaurants serving the chopped up remains of animals whose lives were, by any measure, incalculably more miserable.
A final topic. This summer, a University of Florida student disrupted a John Kerry speech, and as he was being forcibly detained, he yelled to campus police, quote, "Don't tase me, bro." Now the Yale Book of Quotations has chosen that utterance quote of the year. Is the choice good news, bad news, or I don't see how you can see it as no news, but I'll include it anyway, good, bad, or no news?
It's bad news because it trivializes the whole taser issue. There was just a man in Vancouver who was tased by the police at the airport for acting erratically, and he wasn't out of control, but the police, their first attempt to rein him in was tase him, and he died. And dozens of people have died as a result of being tasered. This sort of jokey, don't tase me, bro stuff trivializes what is a very serious issue about police brutality and the overarming of police forces. Tasers are deadly force. They're not a joke, and they're being overused.
Boy, what a bummer. That just bums me out. You know, I frankly didn't like it being picked as the quote of the year. I thought somebody ought to give John McCain some credit for his little retort on the immigration debate. He was asked about illegal aliens, and his response was, they are God's children, and they are human beings.
Sherman, it's bad news because it trivializes all the other quotes that rank below it that deal with larger, huger issues and are serious moments.
I assume you're talking about nappy-headed hoes.
No, not that quote either. Oh. The entire list itself, I think, is more about satire than it is about talking, which I'm a big fan of. But in terms of importance, you know, the John McCain quote, I hadn't seen that one. It was great.
How about Ahmadinejad did say, in Iran, we don't have homosexuals like in your country.
I think that's the quote of the year, that there are no homosexuals in Iran.
If you'd have said we don't have any homosexuals, bro, then I think that changes the dynamics. But don't tase me, bro. It sort of had everything. It had politics. It had technology. It had cheesy slang.
And it had an ineffectual, paralyzed, speechless John Kerry, who stood there at the podium and didn't know how to respond or what to say. And it was like reliving, just in that little bit of tape, that moment, reliving 2004.
Right. If you ever want an explanation of why the man was not elected president of the United States, you had it captured right in that instant.
Maybe that's why it resonated, you know?
In the clutch, John Kerry needed to do something or say something and assert himself one way or the other, and he couldn't. He didn't know what to do. He needed to run out and pull it and come back and then intervene.
Right.
By then it was too late. The guy had been tasered, what, 7 or 8 times?
Okay, that's the news panel. Thanks a lot, and have a great new year.
You too, Bill.
Happy New Year.
Thank you.
Sherbet Alexie has won the 2007 National Book Award for Young People's Literature for The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. His latest novel is called Flight. Linda Chavez now chairs the nonprofit Center for Equal Opportunity. Dan Savage's weekly podcast is called Savage Lovecast.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
Coming up, if you lived here, you'd be home by now. And your clothes would stink. Plug nose and stay tuned to Weekend America.
From American Public Media, we're bringing you stories about the weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke.
Christmas was one of the longest days that I had in Iraq. We were on multiple missions that seemed really stupid, to be honest.
Thousands of Americans will not be home for the holidays because they're fighting overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan. Poet Brian Turner is a veteran. He served 7 years in the Army, one as a team leader in the infantry in Iraq.
Someone said that they'd seen a guy on a motorcycle with a bunch of rocket-propelled grenades strapped to the back. And we were told by one farmer about this, and he said that this other farmer who had a cow knew where this guy with the motorcycle and the RPGs was. So we were looking for a guy with a cow in these orchards and farmlands. We did find the motorcycle, but all it was some guy who was going out into these orchards, strapping down sticks and twigs and branches and stuff that he could find to sell his firewood back in town. And it looked off in the distance, I guess, like an RPG. And it continued from there, just a series of sort of misadventures with really no point to them. It was a very, very long day. But I do remember listening to Louis Armstrong in the back of our Stryker through a radio station that was playing from a nearby base. And he sang What a Wonderful World.
Well, Brian says to survive, he just wouldn't let himself think about home too often. But on his last night away at war, his last night before going stateside, he let his mind wander back home. And out of that longing arose a poem.
When I wrote this poem, my unit had been in country for nearly a year, and we were just about to go home. As the poem says, it was near Almabadi, Iraq, which is south of Mosul. And it was in this one building. It was sandbagged all the way up from the ground to the top floor. In fact, there were black snakes that would nest in those sandbags. And so sometimes we had a little weight room in one of the rooms inside, and baby snakes would get in there. They're very dangerous because they're very poisonous. And I wrote this poem. My squad was in the room, and I had all my gear, but I could take my helmet off, and I could take off my flak vest because we're inside and it's sandbagged. We were shelled there quite a bit, but being inside there, it felt a little safer. So I could, you'd read. I would read. Guys would play cards. There wasn't much else to do. And I remember it wasn't very often that I did this, but I knew that home was approaching. It was sort of on the horizon. It was beginning to be much more possible. I think I was beginning to allow myself little avenues into kind of nostalgia for home. The sort of flashing images of America were kind of going through my head. And I was missing home. And I don't know if anyone's ever been on a bus when it's cold and there's that sort of frost on the glass. And when you sort of wipe it away, you can see people on the sidewalk as you're passing by. And that was the image at the end that I was trying to sort of think about and get at. It's the sound from the aid station that wakes me. Thin steel from Doc Cole's six string. A 4 a.m. sound of sour whiskey, heroin and sex and dying. That's the sound I'm hearing now, slow as smoke from a factory in Pittsburgh, slow as a needle in the vein, slow as steam off the bath or a lover with only the blues to sing. I'm hearing America now. I'm hearing Jake breaks off the grapevine, county highways with wheat shocks and Indian summer grass whispering, foghorns under the Golden Gate Bridge, Ella Fitzgerald from a fourth-floor window in Birmingham, the handles of a suitcase swinging on the downbeat of a man's footsteps walking out from a greyhound in Santa Fe. I'm in Wyoming. I'm in New York. I'm leaning in to kiss a woman in the cornfields down by the river. I'm with children drawing portraits in the sand, old men watching fireflies the way Muhammad Ali lay on the canvas and dreamed. That's what I'm hearing, the wind on the redwood coast, old as the ocean and hushed by sheets of fallen snow. Palm mute the strings, Doc. Strum that song until I can see the breath on a bus window, the faces of strangers in the rain, my own hands tracing the features of every one of them, the way ghosts might visit the ones they love, as I am now, listening to America, touching the cold glass.
Brian Turner has a book of poems called Hear Bullet. He lives in Fresno, California, where he teaches poetry at Fresno State. Now, if you want to, you can reread his poem, Cole's Guitar. Just go to our website at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. Maybe you're listening to us right now as you're driving home for the holidays. The Auto Club says more than 65 million Americans will drive at least a 50-mile trip between now and New Year's. And you know how long those long drives can be. It's get from here to there, and everything in between is a blur.
Yeah, our reporter Chrissy Clark is actually on one of those drives today, right now, in fact.
That's right. She's on her way up the Central Valley of California on Interstate 5, going to Mom's house in the Bay Area. It's a six-hour drive. Chrissy's done it dozens of times, but recently she decided to stop halfway and find out who lives in between.
The little town of Coalinga is almost exactly halfway between Los Angeles and San Francisco in the country's most productive agricultural valley. But neither food nor the funny name are what the town is known for.
That's his eye socket, and his eye socket's 28 inches round, so it's bigger than most everybody's head.
Coalinga is also not known for this giant prehistoric fossil, the upper jawbone of a mastodon, found in the hills outside of town.
They were all over the place. It was nothing to have them be roaming back and forth, so I wouldn't want to run into them, but, you know.
Stephanie McCaney, she's the curator of the local history museum, likes to show off this jawbone and many other things the town is not known for. These things include an extensive collection of famous people's shoes, a complete set of bedroom furniture from a defunct whorehouse.
The women of the night is the way I put it.
There are still more things Coalinga is not known for. Lovely sunsets, the country's first female police chief, and the fact that a man named Jack Tarrington used to ride around town on his motorcycle with a pet mountain lion on the back. Coalinga is not known for any of this.
There it is. Whew.
The thing Coalinga is known for becomes inescapable to anyone who's driving this section of Interstate 5.
Ugh. It tastes like something died in my mouth and then sat and rotted there.
Above all else, Coalinga is known for its smell.
Yeah, it didn't bother me, actually.
And John Harris is the man behind that smell.
It doesn't really smell bad.
John farms 14,000 acres in this valley, and he's driving me to his cattle feedlot, the largest cattle feedlot on the West Coast.
Only about 100,000 here right now.
100,000 steers everywhere, perched on mountains of manure, arching their tails, chewing their corn and malt dinners. And this is where the smell comes from, a fierce blend of feed, sweat, and shit. People who drive past it have been known to call it Cowschwitz.
That's a freeway there. It'd probably been better if we didn't have it right on the freeway, but that's kind of how it worked out.
John says there's plenty of room for the cattle here. He's had animal welfare consultants help on design.
You know, we think that as long as we're you know, very humane in the whole production process and the harvesting process, that there's just nothing wrong with it.
And if you like In-N-Out burgers, you agree. Harris Ranch is a major supplier. As for the smell, John thinks it keeps sleepy drivers awake on this long, straight stretch of highway. John lives 100 miles away from the feedlot and flies to work in a little Cessna.
Awesome.
The prevailing winds in this valley blow from the northwest to the southeast, away from the town of Coalinga, right past the Harris Ranch Steakhouse, and toward Huron, California.
Like in the night, sometimes when I go to the store, it smells, but can't do anything about it, so we got to smell it.
Frances Anguis and her neighbor Lola Gagiola, along with Oso the dog, have all lived in Huron most of their lives. They talk about their town's stereotypes around Lola's kitchen table.
Cholos and drug addicts.
And farm workers fresh from Mexico. While Coalinga is mostly white, Huron is 98% Hispanic. An estimated 90% are undocumented. Frances grew up in Huron. Her husband, who's undocumented, brands cattle in a feedlot, not John Harris's, but another nearby. So she knows that smell very well.
He doesn't want to bring the smell home, so he takes off his clothes over there. Then he comes and take a shower and change again.
Frances and Lola are used to the smell. They say it's actually improved in the last few years. It's still a shock to their friend Ricardo Hernandez. He came here recently from Sonora, Mexico.
Yo pensé que yo era...
He said the first time he smelled it, he thought it was him, that he had stepped on something for the dogs, you know.
Ricardo says the smells he remembers from his hometown in Mexico are strawberry-scented votive candles and the violet perfume of his girlfriend.
Yolanda.
He tugs on a small glass dolphin around his neck. Yolanda loves dolphins.
Does he have plans to go back to Mexico, or is he...
He's not planning to leave. He's comfortable here.
I ask him if his girlfriend plans to leave Mexico and join him here. He sits very still for a while and then shakes his head. No. They talk on the phone every day, though. He can tell her about the smell that sometimes blows around his new home. Pleasant Valley State Prison opened for business in Coalinga in 1994, during California's prison boom. In 2005, the Coalinga State Mental Hospital opened next door. Town officials wanted the well-paying jobs and federal funding that came with the prisons. Now, like a lot of state facilities, Pleasant Valley has more inmates than they know what to do with. They're at more than twice capacity.
You know, some people call us animals or whatever, and I know a lot of people in society look at us like that. And when you have any kind of group, animals, people, whatever, and you confine them to one little area, you're not going to have, any kind of positive things.
Saez Ahmed is an inmate here. He and his fellow prisoners know as much or as little about Coalinga as the passing motorists.
5:30, 5:40, and for some reason the scent just comes in right about that time. So you go to chow smelling cow shit.
It's not. That's the thing. It's not. What it is feed.
Yeah.
I used to haul the Harris Ranch to their feedlot. And
back before.
Yeah, I'm truck drivers. And everybody thinks it's crap. It's part of it, but it's more the feed than it is anything else.
The smell inspires jokes and passionate debate among the four inmates I talk to. Saez, Joseph Moreland, Patrick McCauley, and this man, Dwayne Ray. The smell reminds him of home.
As I told you, I'm from Texas. And to me, it's nothing better than sitting on the porch at 7 o'clock in the morning, drinking a cup of coffee and smelling some cow crap. So it don't bother me one way or the other.
You're sick.
You know?
All four of these men are serving life sentences, all but one as part of the three strikes law, which, incidentally, was written by this area's local congressman.
I got incarcerated when I was kind of young, like 18.
That's Patrick. He's 38 now.
I was still like a kid when I came to jail. But, I think each prison, helps you build that character and helps you build that your mental capability of dealing with stress and pressure.
And it's due to a lot to the overcrowding. These guys are frustrated, especially around Christmas time. People get depressed.
Dwayne says what keeps him positive is brainstorming ways to try to help the community on the outside. He knows how much he and the other inmates cost the state. He wants to give something back. He's got a list of proposals he says he's already written up for the prison administration, like bake sales.
To benefit a family who's lost their home or don't have food, don't have clothes or something, I'd be willing to donate. I know a lot of other people around here, every time they get paid at the end of the month, they might want to go put a dollar or two in there.
At the Pit Stop Bar in Coalinga, you can't really smell the smell unless the wind is just right. But Shannon, the bartender, still uses it as a reference point.
When I would talk to my friends, they never heard of Coalinga. So I would say, the stinky place on the freeway off of 5? And they go, oh yeah, they knew that. So
Shannon's friend, Shay Lynn, just moved to town a few years ago to go to the junior college here.
Once you stop here, you kind of get stuck. It grows on you. Like, you get here, you get involved in things, and then you can't afford to live anywhere else because it's so cheap to live here.
Really small town mentality, and everybody knows about everybody, and everybody likes to get in everybody's business.
I ask these girls if they ever visit the prison that makes up almost half Coalinga's population.
They come around and they clean the, do the yard work around.
But that's about it. I ask them about their neighboring town, Huron, where the farm workers live.
I've never been over there.
No idea.
I heard it's not good, like it's scary.
In fact, like a lot of America, here in Koh Lingah, different groups keep to themselves. One of the only things that does seem to connect everyone here is the smell of this place. Some of the locals call it the smell of money. Some call it disgusting. Some call it part of country living. Whether you like it or hate it, it's an honest smell, a byproduct of the hamburger joints that line the highway. And Shannon, the bartender, tells me, you stop noticing it after a while.
Days or hours?
No, like months.
In Koh Lingah, California, I'm Chrissy Clark for Weekend America.
You can see Koh Lingah for yourself. Our website is not yet fully scratch and sniff enabled. I think Neely's working on that. But the photos are at weekendamerica.org. So enjoy.
Going to be in the high 50s and overcast in Koh Lingah this weekend. Air quality's not too bad, if that's a good thing. For more weather, here's Week in America's John Moe.
59 in Phoenix says bright sun means you'll really be able to see the graffiti in the park. But it's not spray paint, it's ancient petroglyphs. So instead of being an eyesore, it's the subject of a 3-hour interpretive hike. Those ancient people were so wise. Like in that petroglyph that says, squiggly line, man, squiggly line, bear looking thing. How true that is. LaPorte, Texas is big on fun and not so picky when it comes to sticking to a specific theme for their events. They hold a Christmas event with Santa, except that Santa's all decked out in a 1940s motif and he's a swing dancer. Also, he's on board a battleship. 69 degrees, sun, and periodic thunderstorms. Yeah, not even nature knows how to dress for this one. Clouds and 57 as Union, South Carolina turns back the clock to the antebellum period when, history tells us, Christmas was no big deal. The Rose Hill Plantation recalls a time when it just meant a day with family, slightly better food, and modest gifts. Celebratory, but scaled back. Join in for songs like Somewhat Silent Night and We Three Reasonably Important Guys. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
Coming up, the Russian It's a Wonderful Life and other holiday traditions you might want to adopt, next on Weekend America. From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. We are about capturing the spirit of the weekend, and today our theme is home for the holidays. For writer Michael Idov, the question, though, is which holiday? His family immigrated from the Soviet Union 15 years ago, and for complicated reasons, December and January are now for them a never-ending series of celebrations, from Hanukkah to, well, you'll see in a moment. They haven't gotten into Kwanzaa yet, but Michael figures it's just a matter of time before they learn about Seinfeld's Festivus. Here's Michael.
In the Soviet Union, New Year's Eve was the one holiday when you would stay in. No parades, no parties, no politics. It was the best day of the year because it was the only truly private one. Other nearby holidays like Revolution Day and Army Day were loud and heavy on khaki-colored hardware. By contrast, New Year's meant little more than family, close friends, a table, and a few bottles of the oxymoronic Soviet champagne. My parents, Mark and Yelena, carefully decorated the New Year's fir tree with vintage blown glass ornaments. Some of those dated back to the 1940s, and chief among them was an unfathomably scary clown head that was supposed to hang facing into the corner. The one year that it spun around on its string and faced the room, my grandfather died, two events which, in my parents' mind, had a solid cause and effect relationship. Finally, like everyone else in the country, we would watch An Irony of Fate. It's a romantic comedy from the early 80s, which state television faithfully broadcast every New Year's Eve. The movie is kind of the Russian It's a Wonderful Life, except with more booze. The protagonist finds true love on January 1st after waking up hungover in a different city from the one where he started celebrating.
Где я? Там же, где я. А вы где?
В аэропорту.
In 92, my family immigrated to the States, settling in Cleveland. The tree ornaments miraculously survived the move, including, to my chagrin, the clown head. There was, however, a problem. In the new context, our beloved New Year's fir tree was now a Christmas tree, laden with religious significance. My family have been fiercely secular for the last five or six generations, but technically we're Jewish. In Cleveland, we lived in a rickety apartment complex populated almost entirely by recent arrivals from the USSR, old Jews like us, and there was a tree glowing in every window. A few days before the New Year, local Hasidic activists began knocking on people's doors, distributing free menorahs, and trying to get us to renounce our tree. In apartment after apartment, the conversation went the same. They said, "You're Jewish, and Jews are not supposed to have a Christmas tree." "It's not a Christmas tree, it's a New Year's fir," we insisted. Still, free menorahs did their part, and my family began to half-heartedly celebrate Hanukkah.
Обязательно что-нибудь вкусное готовим, то, что полагается готовить на эти праздники.
My mother, Елена, says it's all about cooking Jewish. This year we got potato latkes and apple latkes.
But no Hanukkah guilt.
No.
Then it's time for Christmas. We celebrate that in tribute to some Baptist friends who helped us out in the difficult late Soviet years. There were food shortages in 1990, and my mom befriended a woman named Margit from Finland. Margit proceeded to mail us care packages stocked with rice, pasta, and the occasional Life of Jesus video. So on December 25th, we say a toast to her. Our New Year's fir tree goes up triumphantly on December 26th. You can get trees at a pretty steep discount after Christmas. Our decoration ceremony hasn't changed a bit since the Soviet years, and still includes the horrifying clown. But now there's a new tradition whose genesis I missed. That's when the family's two rather surly cats, named for some reason Enrique and Trisha, get their own tiny tree.
А у нас одна маленькая ёлка, мы ставим её отдельно, она украшена только кошками и мышками.
Mom's bought all new ornaments that reference cats and mice. Sometimes the kitty tree goes up earlier, since our cats are presumably Christian. Okay, Mom, moving on to what is still the main event. New Year's Eve. Over the last few years, my parents tried celebrating it the American way, by going out to a concert or to a restaurant, but they can't get the hang of that. My mother complains that last year the restaurant had insufferably loud music. Dad says next time maybe she should go to a quiet classical concert and sit in the last row. Or better yet, in the basement of the building. So, this year, it's back to a low-key evening at home, watching An Irony of Fate, now on DVD.
Думайте сами, решайте сами, иметь или не иметь, иметь или не иметь.
But wait, we still have Russian Orthodox Christmas on January 7th, because at this point, why not? Still, we're not done yet, and neither is Russia. Before the revolution, the Russian calendar was 13 days behind the Western one. So when the Bolsheviks synced the old country up with the rest of the world, people decided there was no sense in losing a perfectly good holiday. Russians still celebrate this phantom day, called Old New Year, on January 13. It means nothing to us, but it's an excuse to prolong the holidays, my mom says. Or, in the words of my grandmother, it's another reason to drink. On January 14th, the New Year's Fair exits the house, leaving behind a trail of dead needles. Some of them will still be in the carpet at the start of the next go-around, now less than 11 months away. In Southfield, Michigan, I'm Michael Ida for Weekend America.
And you can see Michael's family holiday setup, including the New Year's fur, at weekendamerica.org. Michael's mom, Yelena, took a picture of the scary clown ornament, but only from the side angle, so that its curse will not radiate out into the world. And that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. Our program is produced with Ben Adair, Julia Barton, Sean Cole, Nelia Lell, who's vacationing on the Mendocino Coast after relaunching our website. Well-deserved. Neely, check it out, weekendamerica.org. Millie Jefferson, Sam Keenan is desperately shopping this weekend. Michael Rayfield, Susie Lechtenberg, Tim Bomba's hitting the 53-degree water of the Pacific Ocean, wetsuit included.
Also, Johnny Vince Evans, who's throwing his fiancée into the back of the Subaru and heading to Wisconsin for the holidays. Chrissy Clark, Brendan Noonan, Phyllis Owens, Angela Kim, whose mom is spending her first weekend as a U.S. citizen, John Moe, and Mark Sanchez.
Our theme music was created by Galactic. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show, and you can get a free podcast of that show anytime. Just go to our website, weekendamerica.org. We're glad you spent the hour with us. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Hey, Weekend Americans, have a happy holiday season.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
This is Bill Radke, host of Weekend America. The weekends are for courage.
Yeah, when you come in here and you see a whole bunch of people in there, hey, they go Pookie, they go Mikey. You know, I ain't expect to see him here. It make you kind of feel like, okay, well, if they're going to do it, then I can do it.
Conquering errands, braving to-do lists, listening to the most memorable stories and ideas every Saturday. Weekend America. Join us.